have the ultimate truth, there's always more to be learned. So what do we do? The fire asked. Without hesitation, Brandon said, we act on the information we have. We message Earth all the information we've discovered here and warn them about the gamma burst. We keep on working with Audrey's people and plan out how we can help Earth and the other worlds that are in danger. Thornberry piped up. We can build energy shields that'll protect Earth from the gamma burst, Bigod. Right, said Brandon. That's what we've got to do. Who says no to that? No one stirred, not even Meek. No one lifted a hand in objection or raised a voice. Jordan, still on his feet, looked down at Brandon. You took charge at last, he said silently. You've become a man, baby brother. But then he looked across the table at Harmon Meek, who was sitting rigidly, his long face crumbling into a mask of despair. Exoplanet. Quoth the Raven, nevermore. Edgar Allan Poe, The Raven. Homeworld. 2,000 light-years closer to the core of the Milky Way galaxy than Earth, a small, rocky planet orbited tightly around a tiny, faint red dwarf star. The planet hugged its parent star so closely that its year was only 5 Earth days long. Its locked rotation kept one side always facing the meager warmth of its dim parent star, one side perpetually dark and cold. The star was one of the galaxy's most commonplace, faint and cool, but destined to continue shining feebly long after giant bright beacons such as Sirius had depleted their nuclear energy sources and destroyed themselves in titanic explosions. The planet orbiting it was a world of stark contrasts. Jagged cliffs and harsh deserts surrounding seething purple seas that crashed against the rugged cliffs and sent huge waves of violent surf surging across beaches of ruby-red sand. Those seas teemed with life, and living creatures inhabited those deserts, carved homes for themselves in those cliffs, soared across the brooding scarlet skies. One species of life on that planet was intelligent. Part animal, part plant, they called themselves the people, and called their planet home. A brood of them was flying across the rocky desert, gliding on the tidal wind that blew unfailingly across their world, high above the rugged cliffs, their backs to the red sun that filled half their sky. They were long, thin, ethereal creatures, gliding on wide gossamer wings that drank in the feeble sunlight, searching for one of their family who had wandered far from their usual haunts. Across the barren landscape they soared, incomplete as long as one of them was missing. They headed away from their sun, toward the distant shadowed land that bordered the half of their world that was always in darkness. This is foolishness, grumbled one of them. The farther from the sun we fly, the weaker we become. It's cold here, complained another. How can we bud in such a wasteland? We cannot bud until we are complete, said their leader, the oldest among them. We must find Fenhe. Then we can return to the warmth and begin to bud. One of the others complained, Fenhe has always been strange, a loner. It would be better to bud without Fenhe. Leave the strange one in solitude. That is not our way, said the leader sternly. We must have unity before we can bud. I see Fenhe, cried their youngest, flying some distance ahead of the others. It extruded an arm from its malleable body, pointing. And there was Fenhe, a thin filmy reed, standing with wings folded about its body on an outcropping of rock. Roots wormed into the thin layer of nourishing soil, swaying gently in the tidal breeze. Head turned toward the darkest part of the sky. The others fluttered about Fenhe, and one by one landed around it. Their roots found precious little nutrition in the meager soil that coated the underlying rock. What are you doing here, Fenhe? Demanded the eldest. Don't you realize you are required for the budding? Fenhe turned toward the eldest, its heat-sensitive eye plates so enlarged they covered most of its upper body. Extruding an arm, it pointed into the dark sky. Look, it said. The others stared into the darkness. As their eye plates adapted and grew, they saw that the inky sky was peppered with specks of light. "What are they?" asked one of the brood.
"I don't know," said Fenhe. "I first saw them many cycles ago when I was blown to the dark side by a storm."
"Lights in the sky?" wondered another. "What does it mean?"
"They exist only on the dark side of home," said Fenhe.
Then it added,
"Or perhaps they are too faint to be seen where the sun fills the sky."
"They are meaningless," decided the eldest. "Come, Fenhe, you are needed for the budding."
"But they are so beautiful."
"You are needed. You must come." Reluctantly, Fenhe bowed and stretched its wings wide. The entire brood disengaged from the soil and took flight. Fenhe turned its head for one final look at the flecks of light. Its breath caught in its throat. The sky was becoming brighter. The darkness was changing into light. Hard, fierce light, so brilliant it hurt its eye plates. Fenhe turned away from the growing light, but it was no use. The entire sky was ablaze. It saw the eldest's wings crumple, and it plunged to the ground, smoking and shrieking. All the others screamed and died, falling like burning leaves. Fenhe felt itself burning, roasting as the sky blazed furiously, and even the soil below and the rocks themselves began to smolder. Everyone died. The people were no more. The planet they called home was reduced to a smoking ruin of rubble-strewn bare rock. Surging past at the speed of light, the gamma burst enveloped everything, and then sped onward, outward, spreading death wherever it touched. Crusaders. Far and away, the best prize that life has to offer is the chance to work hard at work worth doing. Theodore Roosevelt. Base camp. "I'm proud of you, Bran," said Jordan. "You've become a leader." Brandon smiled shyly. "With your help, Jordy. With your help." The two brothers were walking alone through the white mounds of their camp's bubble tents beneath the darkening sky. The first few stars were appearing in the gathering twilight. Jordan knew that Earth's sun would be visible once the night became fully dark. It would appear as a faint yellowish star, undistinguished and terribly far away. "I wish there was some way we could convince Harmon that Audrey's people mean us no harm," Jordan said. Brandon huffed. "Makes a lost cause. He's scared out of his wits. He'll never be able to adapt to this situation." They walked along slowly, out toward the periphery of their camp. The forest trees sighed in the soft night breeze. Jordan thought of Aditi back in the city, waiting for him. Waiting for the people from Earth to make up their minds. Turning toward his brother, Jordan said, "Bran, we've got to present a united front back home. We can't have a divided team. We can't have Harmon giving them a dissenting minority report." Brandon nodded. "That'd give the naysayers a reason to deny everything we have to tell them." Jordan thought of other times, earlier crises that had been worsened by inaction. World War II. The American Civil War. "We might have avoided the greenhouse floods if we'd acted early enough, strongly enough," he said to himself. Strangely, Brandon began to chuckle softly. "Something funny? I was just thinking about the Neanderthals." "What in the—" "I was picturing a council of Neanderthals, sitting in their cave around a fire, debating what they should do about global warming." "You have a weird sense of humor, Bran." "No, Jordy. Imagine it. Here they are, beautifully adapted to the Ice Age. But the climate's warming up, the glaciers are melting away, and they're squatting around their fire wondering what to do." "There wasn't much they could do," said Jordan. "They could have adapted. They could have changed their ways and adapted to the warmer climate." "Could they?" Jordan wondered. "As you say, they were physically adapted for the Ice Age climate. They were intelligent, Jordy, as intelligent as we are. They had larger brains than we do, actually. But some of them lived in the Middle East, you know.